Day 180, GC Standard 306. The Wayne. Seated safely behind the window of their quarters, Ohan gazed into the black hole. With some effort, they could remember how the galaxy had looked during their host's childhood, before infection. Flat, vacant, blank. So much of existence was lost to a mind untouched by the Whisperer. Their alien companions had such minds. Ohan pitied them. Looking only with their eyes, Ohan's view of the activity taking place along the edges of the black hole's accretion disk was no different from the way the rest of the crew saw it. A flock of unmanned skimmer drones sailed as close as they could safely get to the event horizon, just on the edge of gravity's embrace. They drifted through the swirling silt, and to the ordinary observer, they would appear to be doing nothing but drawing dust trails with their comb-like arms. But if Ohan looked with their mind, mapped it all out with the right numbers and notions, the space outside became a majestic, violent place. Around the skimmer's arms, raw energy tumbled and boiled, like a thrashing sea churning up flotsam. Tendrils of the stuff curled up around the combs, arching and writhing as they were coaxed into the collection hoppers, or so Ohan imagined. They pressed close to the window, in awe of the storm that lay beyond sight. And again, they thought of what their crewmates would see. An empty patch of space, blacker than black, and little skimmers collecting invisible cargo. How still the universe must look to their eyes, Ohan thought. How silent. That invisible cargo was what their captain had come to purchase. Ashby was probably haggling over the price of ambi cells at that very moment. Raw ambi, the stuff Ohan envisioned torquing around the skimmer combs, was difficult to gather. Ambi could be found everywhere and in everything, but the way that it weaved itself around ordinary matter made extracting it a troublesome task. With the right technology, it could be wrenched apart, but the process was so tedious and reaped such small rewards that it wasn't worth the effort. It was far easier to gather ambi somewhere where matter was already being ripped apart by forces greater than anything any sapient could build, like a black hole. Black holes were always surrounded by turbulent seas of free-floating ambi, but getting close enough to gather it posed an obvious risk. For ambi traders, the risk was worth it, especially since it allowed them to charge a premium. As expensive as ambi cells were, they were the only thing that could power the Wayfarer's interspatial bore. It was a necessary expense for a ship such as theirs, but one that always left Ashby looking a little gray afterward. Ohan had read of ships powered entirely by ambi cells, but they had trouble conceiving of a life in which such an extravagance was affordable. Ohan picked up the razor that lay beside the wash basin near their feet. They clicked a skipping rhythm with their tongue as they trimmed the patterns in their fur. The swirls of fur and clicks of tongue meant nothing to their crewmates, but they meant everything to Ohan. Every pattern represented a cosmological truth, every series of clicks an abstraction of the universe's underlying mathematics. These were symbols and sounds every synapse pair knew. They wore the layers of the universe upon their skin, drummed its beat with their mouths. A sharp twinge blossomed deep within their wrist, and for a moment, the pair lost control of their hand. The razor slipped, nicking their skin. Ohan chirped, more out of surprise than pain. They wrapped the fingers of their other hand around the wound, rocking back and forth for a moment as the feeling faded to a quiet burn. Ohan exhaled. They looked down to the cut. Thin blood oozed forth, matting a tiny patch of fur. But the razor had not gone deep. Ohan stood stiffly and walked to the dresser in search of a bandage. This was the first stage of the wane, stiffness and muscle spasms. Eventually, the pain would spread to their bones, and their muscles would become increasingly difficult to control. The pain would then disappear completely, but this was a devious mercy. as it indicated that their nerve fibers had begun to die. Death would come afterward, in its own time. The wane was an inevitability in a Cyanat pair's life. Though the Whisperer unlocked the mind of the host, it also shortened their life. Solitaries, blasphemous hosts that avoided infection, a crime punished by exile, reportedly could live well over 100 standards, but no pair had ever lived to be more than 30. From time to time, alien doctors would come forward, offering to help cure the wane, but they were always refused. There could be no chance of a treatment damaging the genetic stability of the Whisperer. The infection was sacred. It could not be tampered with. The wane was a fair price to pay for enlightenment. Even so, Ohan was afraid. They could disconnect themselves from the fear, but it lingered, like an unpleasant taste in the back of the throat. Fear. Such a throwback emotion, meant to spur primitive life forms away from potential predators. Life's universal constant. Every fear of rejection, of criticism, of failure, of loss. These were all caused by the same archaic survival reflex. Ohan knew that their own fear of death was nothing more than some primitive synapses firing within their host's brain, the emotional equivalent of jerking a hand away from a hot surface. When they reached for the higher parts of their mind, they knew that death was nothing to fear. Why should they fear something that came to all life forms? In some ways, having reached the wane was a comfort to Ohan. It meant that they had been successful in avoiding a sudden, premature end. Ashby and Dr. Sheff were the only ones who knew that Ohan had begun to wane. The captain attempted to carry on as normal, though he often asked Ohan in a hushed voice how they were feeling, if there was anything he could do. Dr. Sheff, kind creature that he was, had taken the trouble to contact Cyanat doctors to learn more about the wane's effects. A few days after the wayfarer left Coriel, Dr. Sheff had presented Ohan with a variety of homemade tinctures and teas, made from herbs recommended for easing the pain. Ohan had been touched, though as always, they did not know how to adequately express their thanks. Gift-giving was unheard of in Cyanat culture, and Ohan were always ill-equipped to express gratitude for such gestures. They believed that Dr. Sheff understood this social limitation. In a way, Dr. Sheff could see into the hearts of others as well as Ohan themselves could see the universe. Ohan often wondered if Dr. Sheff knew what a gift that was. Bandage in place and blood cleaned away, Ohan returned to the window. They picked up the razor, clicking their cheek as they dragged the blade through their fur. As they did so, they thought of the concept of purpose. Dr. Sheff's purpose was to heal and nourish. Ashby's purpose was to bind his crew together. Accepting the wane ran contrary to those purposes. For them, accepting the death of a crew member was difficult. Ohan hoped they knew how much the effort was appreciated. Ohan's own purpose was to be a navigator, to unveil the universe for those who were blind to it. After death, Ohan would no longer be able to pursue that purpose, and they could not deny that this saddened them. At least there would be time for one more job, this new tunnel at Hedra Ka. The wane had only begun its first stage. There was time for a tunnel before succumbing. Ohan hoped that Ashby was not uncomfortable with letting them embrace the wane's final stage aboard the Wayfarer. They could think of nothing more fitting than dying in the place that housed their purpose. Ohan looked again into the black hole. They closed their eyes and pictured great swaths of fragmented matter falling and pressing endlessly. Larab, they would call it in their native tongue, a word to describe form. And Grus, too. A word for the color of unseen matter. There were no words in Clip for the colors or shapes that lay beyond sight. They had tried at times to explain these things to the Wayfarer's crew, but there were no words, no abstractions that could open their crewmates' limited minds. Ohan preferred to take in the sight alone, especially now. A black hole was the perfect place to contemplate death. There was nothing in the universe that could last forever. Not stars. Not matter. Nothing. The razor cut. Their wrist ached. The sky roiled. Unseen. Feed source. Reskett Museum of Natural Sciences. Archival Library. Public/Reskettkish. Item name. Thoughts on the Galaxy, Chapter 3. Author. Oshet tek shehereket, eskrahist, as ehas, karish isket, ishkriset. Encryption 0. Translation path. Reskettkish, clip. Transcription 0. Node identifier. 9874-457-28. Rosemary Harper. When meeting an individual of another species for the first time, there is no sapient in the galaxy who does not immediately take inventory of Zaire physiological differences. These are always the first things we see. How does Zaire's skin differ? Does Z have a tail? How does Z move? How does Z pick things up? What does Z eat? Does Z have abilities that I don't, or vice versa? These are all important distinctions, but the more important comparison is the one we make after this point. Once we've made our mental checklists of variations, we begin to draw parallels, not between the alien and ourselves, but between the alien and animals. The majority of us have been taught since childhood that voicing these comparisons is derogatory, and indeed, many of the racial slurs in colloquial use are nothing more than common names for non-sapient species. For example, the human term lizard to describe Andrisks, the Quaylan term tick to describe humans, the Andrisk term sersh to describe Quaylan. Though these terms are offensive, examining them objectively reveals a point of major biological interest. All demeaning implications aside, we Andrisks do look like some of the native reptilian species of Earth. Humans do look like larger bipedal versions of the hairless primates that plague the sewer systems of Quaylan cities. Quaylan do bear some resemblance to the snapping crustaceans found all over Hashkath. And yet, we evolved separately and on different worlds. My people and the lizards of Earth do not share an evolutionary tree, nor do humans and ticks, nor Quaylan and sersh. Our points of origin are spread out across the galaxy. We hail from systems that remained self-contained for billions of years, with evolutionary clocks that all began at different times. How is it possible that when meeting our galactic neighbors for the first time, we are all instantly reminded of creatures back home, or in some cases, of ourselves? The question becomes even more complicated when we start to look beyond our superficial differences to the wealth of similarities. All sapient species have brains. Let us consider that seemingly obvious fact for a moment. Despite our isolated evolutionary paths, we all develop nervous systems with a central hub. We all have internal organs. We all share at least some of the same physical senses: hearing, touch, taste, smell, sight, electroreception. The grand majority of sapients have either 4 or 6 limbs. Bipedalism and opposable digits, while not universal, are shockingly common. We are all made from chromosomes and DNA, which themselves are made from a select handful of key elements. We all require a steady intake of water and oxygen to survive, though in varying quantities. We all need food. We all buckle under atmospheres too thick or gravitational fields too strong. We all die in freezing cold or burning heat. We all die, period. How can this be? How is it that life, so diverse on the surface, has followed the same pattern throughout the galaxy? Not just in the current era, but over and over again. We see this pattern in the ruins of the Arcanic civilization at Shisha, or the ancient fossil beds on the now barren world of Okik. This is a question that scientific communities have wrestled with for centuries, and it seems unlikely that an answer will present itself in the near future. There are many theories: asteroids carrying amino acids, supernovae blowing organic material out into neighboring systems, and yes, There is a fanciful story of a hyper-advanced sapient race seeding the galaxy with genetic material. I admit that the Galactic Gardener hypothesis has fueled the plots of some of my favorite science fiction sims, but scientifically speaking, it is nothing more than wishful thinking. You cannot have a theory without evidence, and there is absolutely none that supports this idea, no matter what the conspiracy theorists lurking on linking feeds would have you believe. For my part, I think that the best explanation is the simplest one. The galaxy is a place of laws. Gravity follows laws. The life cycles of stars and planetary systems follow laws. Subatomic particles follow laws. We know the exact conditions that will cause the formation of a red dwarf, or a comet, or a black hole. Why, then, can we not acknowledge that the universe follows similarly rigid laws of biology? We have only ever discovered life on similarly sized terrestrial moons and planets, orbiting within a narrow margin around hospitable stars. If we all evolved on such kindred worlds, why is it such a surprise that our evolutionary paths have so much in common? Why can we not conclude that the right combination of specific environmental factors will always result in predictable physical adaptations? With so much evidence staring us in the face, why does this debate continue? The answer, of course, is that the laws of biology are nearly impossible to test. And scientists hate that. We can launch probes to test theories of gravity and space-time. We can put rocks in pressure cookers and split atoms in classrooms. But how does one test a process as lengthy and multifaceted as evolution? There are labs today that struggle to find the funding to keep a project running for 3 standards. Imagine the funding needed to run a project for millennia. As it stands, there is no way for us to efficiently test the conditions that produce specific biological adaptations beyond the most rudimentary observations. Aquatic climates produce fins, cold climates produce fur or blubber, and so on. There have been bold attempts at creating software that could accurately predict evolutionary paths, such as the Aileuon-funded TEP-PREM project, which, though well-intentioned, has yet to unravel the mysteries of biological law. The problem with such endeavors is that there are too many variables to consider, many of which we remain ignorant of. We simply don't have enough data, and the data that we do possess is still beyond our understanding. We are experts of the physical galaxy. We live on terraformed worlds and in massive orbital habitats. We tunnel through the sublayer to hop between stellar systems. We escape planetary gravity with the ease of walking out the front door. But when it comes to evolution, we are hatchlings, fumbling with toys. I believe this is why many of my peers still cling to theories of genetic material scattered by asteroids and supernovae. In many ways, the idea of a shared stock of genes drifting through the galaxy is far easier to accept than the daunting notion that none of us may ever have the intellectual capacity to understand how life truly works. Day 245, GC Standard 306. Intro to Hermogian Colonial History. Sissix peeked around the doorframe. The hallway was empty. If she moved fast, she might make it to the med bay before anybody saw her. She hugged a bathrobe, borrowed from a pile of Kizzy's clean laundry, around herself and hurried forward. As she moved, the itch spread up from her thighs and over her belly. She rubbed her palms against it through the fabric, barely resisting the urge to dig in with her claws. She wanted to throw off the robe and roll around against the metal floor, against a rough barked tree, against a sanding block, anything, so long as she could rid herself of this dry, burning, aching, shallow, hateful itch. "Whoa, sis," Jenks said, skidding to a halt as she rounded a corner. "You almost ran me." His words stopped once he got a look at her. "Holy shit, you look terrible." "Thanks, Jenks, you're such a help," she said, continuing on her way. She wasn't embarrassed, she told herself, just angry. Yes. Angry that this had happened at all. Angry at how many times in her life she'd had to put up with it. Angry at people not just leaving her the hell alone. "Sissix, hey," Rosemary said, appearing from behind a door, scrib in hand. "I was coming to see—" "Oh." Her dumb, wet mammal eyes widened. She brought a hand to her mouth.
I'm fine, Sissek said, never pausing for a moment.
With as big as the ship was, you'd think it was possible for a person to get from point A to point B without constantly running into,
fuck off, Corbin,
Sissek said to the pink human, who had just ascended from the lower decks. He froze at the top of the staircase, looking stupid and confused as she hurried past. She burst into the med bay, shutting the door as soon as she was through. Dr. Scheff looked up from his workstation. He rumbled sympathetically.
Oh, poor girl, he said. You're molting. I'm early, too.
She glanced at herself in the mirror. Blistering pockets of dead skin had separated from her face, tearing raggedly at the edges.
I didn't think I'd start for another 3 10-days, and I haven't... Ah! Oh!
The itch started up again, though it had never really stopped. Her whole face felt like it was crawling with flies. She gave in to the impulse and clawed.
Hey now, none of that,
Dr. Scheff said, coming forward to take her wrists.
You'll hurt yourself.
No, I won't, Sissek
said. She was acting childish, but she didn't care. Her face was about to fall off. She had a right to be petulant. Dr. Scheff pushed up his sleeve.
Really?
He said. He lifted her arm so she could see the light claw marks on her flaking skin. A faint crust of blood lingered where her claws had scratched too deep during the night.
Stars, you're parental sometimes, Sissek mumbled.
I feed you and heal you. How else am I supposed to be? Take off that robe, let's sort you out.
Thank you.
She took off her robe as Dr. Scheff opened a storage panel. He took out a misting bottle and a Rixith, a small, flat board with a rough coating on one side. Kizzy had once called it a nail file for your entire self.
Where's worst? Dr. Scheff asked.
Sissek lay back on the examination table.
Everywhere, she sighed.
My arms, I guess?
Dr. Scheff gently took her right arm, the one with the bloody patch, and sprayed medicated mist over it. The dry skin went translucent, lifting at the edges. He went to work with the Rixith, rubbing the wet pieces away. Sissek breathed a little easier, urging the rest of her body to be patient. Dr. Scheff took one of her fingers between his own, examining it.
How's the skin feel here?
Tight. It's not ready to come up.
Oh, I think it is. It just doesn't know it yet.
He moistened her skin and, with steady pressure, massaged her hand from wrist to claws. After a few minutes, she could feel an edge come loose near her wrist. Dr. Scheff worked his fingers underneath carefully, gripping it between two finger pads. In one swift motion, he tore the dead skin free from her entire hand, like pulling off a glove. Sissek yelped, then moaned. The new skin was sensitive, but the itch there was gone. She exhaled.
Stars, you're good at that.
I've had some practice, he said,
continuing up her arm with the Rixith. Sissek craned her neck up to make sure the door was fully closed.
Do you ever get tired of humans?
On occasion. I think that's normal for anyone living with people other than their own. I'm sure they get tired of us, too.
I'm definitely tired of them today,
Sissek said, laying her head back.
I'm tired of their fleshy faces. I'm tired of their smooth fingertips. I'm tired of how they pronounce their R's. I'm tired of their inability to smell anything. I'm tired of how clingy they get around kids that don't even belong to them. I'm tired of how neurotic they are about being naked. I want to smack every single one of them around until they realize how needlessly complicated they make their families and their social lives and their everything.
Dr. Scheff nodded.
You love them and you understand them, but sometimes you wish they, and me and Ohan too, I'm sure, could be more like ordinary people.
Exactly.
She sighed, her frustration simmering down.
And it's not like they've done anything wrong. You know how much this crew means to me, but today, I don't know. Feels like having a mess of younger hatchmates who won't stop playing with your toys. They're not breaking anything, and you know they're only trying to please you, but they're so little and annoying, and you want them all to fall down a well, temporarily.
Dr. Chef gave a rumbling chuckle. It seems your diagnosis is more complicated than just a premature molt.
How so?
He smiled. You're homesick.
She sighed again. Yeah.
We're stopping off at Hashcath before the end of the standard, right? That's not so horribly far, he said, patting her head. He stopped and rubbed one of her feathers between his finger pads. Have you been taking your mineral supplements?
She glanced away. Sometimes.
You need to take them all times. Your feathers are a little limp.
I'm molting.
Dr. Chef frowned. It's not because you're molting, he said. It's because you're deficient in the basic nutrients that every Andrisk needs. If you don't start taking your minerals regularly, I'm going to start feeding you moss paste. She made a face. The very notion of the stuff brought back childhood memories of the taste. Bitter, dusty, lingering.
Okay, Hatchfather, whatever you say.
Dr. Chef rumbled in thought.
What?
Nothing. The phrase just struck me as odd, he said, his voice light. I was only ever a mother.
I'm sorry, Sissix said. I didn't mean...
Oh, don't. It's only true. He looked back to her, the twinkle returning to his eye. Besides, if you think of me as a parent, maybe you'll listen when I tell you to take your damn minerals. She laughed.
I doubt it. There was a stretch in my childhood when my Hatch family couldn't get me to eat anything but snap fruit.
She hissed as he worked the Rixith against a stubborn patch on her shoulder. At least snap fruit's good for you, and somehow it doesn't surprise me that you were a willful child. He thought aloud and laughed. I bet you were a real pain.
Of course I was, Sissix said with a grin. I wasn't a person yet.
Dr. Chef's cheeks rippled in disagreement. Now, see, there's something about your species that I will never understand. She let out a congenial sigh.
You and the rest of the galaxy, she said.
Honestly, what was it about that concept that was so difficult for others to grasp? She would never, ever understand the idea that a child, especially an infant, was more of value than an adult who had already gained all the skills needed to benefit the community. The death of a new hatchling was so common as to be expected. The death of a child about to feather? Yes, that was sad. But a real tragedy was the loss of an adult with friends and lovers and family. The idea that a loss of potential was somehow worse than a loss of achievement and knowledge was something she had never been able to wrap her brain around. Dr. Chef glanced over his shoulder, even though no one had entered the room.
Hey, I have a confession to make.
Oh? I haven't told anybody this. This is secret. Top, top secret.
He had lowered his voice as much as he physically could. Sissix nodded with exaggerated seriousness.
I will say nothing. You know how you said humans can't smell anything?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've noticed that the humans aboard this ship don't smell nearly as bad as other humans.
Yeah, I've gotten used to them.
Wrong.
He paused with dramatic importance.
I routinely mix a potent anti-odor powder into the soap dispensers in the showers. I rub it into Kizzy's solid soap, too.
Sissix stared at him for a moment before crooning with laughter.
Oh,
she said, gasping for breath.
Oh, you don't.
I certainly do, he said, puffing his cheeks. I started doing it not a 10 day after I took this job. And do you know what the best part is?
They can't tell the difference.
Dr. Chef let loose an amused harmony.
They can't tell the difference.
They were both still laughing when Ashby walked through the door. His hair was wet. He had clearly just bathed. Sissix and Dr. Chef fell silent. The laughter returned, even stronger than before. Do I want to know? Ashby said, his eyes shifting between them.
We're making fun of humans, Sissek said.
Right, said Ashby. Then I definitely don't want to know. He nodded toward her. Molt came early.
Yeah.
My sympathies. I'll take over your cleaning shift.
Oh, you're the best.
That was wonderful news. Cleaning products and new skin did not mix well. Remember that the next time you're laughing at us lowly primates. Rosemary sat flicking through files in her office. Well, what passed for an office. It had been a storage room before she arrived, and technically still was, given the modest stack of crates against the far wall. The whole setup was a far cry from the sleek desk she'd had at Red Rock Transport, even as an intern. But she liked Dr. Chef's snack counter far more than the austere corporate cafeteria, and besides, she didn't need anything fancy to do her job. She had a simple desk and a big interface panel and a small pixel plant Jenks had given her to make up for the lack of a window. Why was it that people who worked with numbers always got tucked away in back rooms? The plant looked nothing like the real thing, of course. The smiling face and color-changing petals resembled nothing in nature. It was programmed with some behavioral recognition software that could tell when she'd gone a while without standing or drinking or taking a break, and would chirp cheerful reminders in response. Hey there! You need to hydrate! How about a snack? Take a walk! Stretch it out! The effect was cheesy, and sometimes a little jarring when she was focused on her work, but she appreciated the sentiment. She sipped a mug of boring tea as she puzzled over one of Kizzy's expense sheets. The mech tech had a habit of annotating things with shorthand that she alone understood. At first, Rosemary had assumed that it was some sort of tech lingo, but no. Jenks had quietly confirmed that this was Kizzy's own special way of staying organized. Rosemary squinted at the screen. 5,500 credits-ish. WRSS. She made a flicking motion with her left hand, pulling up a file entitled Kizzy Speak, her cheat sheet for acronyms that she had deciphered. ES, engine stuff. TB, tools and bits. CRCT, circuits. But no, WRSS wasn't there. She made a note to ask Kizzy about it. The door spun open, and Corbin entered the room. Before she could say hello, he set a black mechanical object on her desk.
What's this? He asked.
Her heart hammered, as it usually did whenever Corbin approached her. Speaking to him always felt like more of an ambush than a conversation. She looked at the object. That's the saline filter I ordered for you.
Yes, he said. Notice anything?
Rosemary swallowed. She looked harder at the filter, which she only recognized as a filter because there'd been a picture of it on the merchant's linking page. She gave an awkward smile. I can't say that I know much about algae tech, she said, trying to keep her voice easy.
That much is obvious, Corbin said.
He flipped the filter around and pointed to the label.
Model 4546-C44.
He stared at her, expectantly.
Oh, no. Rosemary's mind raced, trying to remember the order form. There had been so many. Was that not what you wanted?
Corbin's sour face answered her question.
I specifically asked for the C-45. The C-44 has a coupling port that is narrower than the junction in the tank. I'll have to add a new attachment in order to make it connect properly.
Rosemary had been pulling archived forms as he spoke. There it was. Triton Advanced Saline Filter. Model 4546-C45. Shit.
I'm so sorry, Corbin. I don't know what happened. I must have selected the wrong model, but at least this one will work, right?
The second the words were out of her mouth, she knew they had been a mistake.
That's not the point, Rosemary,
Corbin said, as if speaking to a child.
What if I had required something more vital than a saline filter? You said it yourself. You don't know much about algae tech. You can get away with mistakes like this in some cushy planet-side office, but not on a long-haul ship. The smallest component can be the difference between getting to port safely and decompressing out in the open.
I'm sorry, Rosemary said again. I'll be more careful next time.
See that you are.
Corbin picked up the filter and walked to the door.
It really isn't that hard.
he said with his back to her. The door spun shut behind him. Rosemary sat staring at her desk. Sissix had told her not to let Corbin get under her skin, but she had screwed up this time, and it was a careless mistake, too. Decompressing didn't sound so bad right then.
"Aw, it's not so bad," chirped the pixel plant. "Give yourself a hug."
"Oh, shut up," Rosemary said. Ashby tripped over a length of tubing as he walked through the engine room.
"What?"
He craned his head around the corner to find an avalanche of cables pouring out of the wall. The entire bracing panel had been removed. He tiptoed his way around the tangled mess, careful not to step on any fluid-filled tubes. As he approached the open wall, he heard someone sniff.
"Kizzy?"
The mech tech was sitting inside the wall, hugging her knees, tools scattered alongside. Her face was smudged with gunk and grease, as usual, but a tear or two had created clean pathways down her cheeks. She looked up at him pitifully. Even the ribbons in her hair looked limp.
"I'm having a bad day," she said.
Ashby leaned inside the open panel.
"What's up?"
She sniffed again, rubbing her nose with the back of her hand.
"I slept awful. I had nightmares out the ass, and by the time I got to sleep, my alarm was going off, so today was dumb from the get-go. And then I was like, hey, I've still got some jam cakes left, and that cheered me up. But then I got to the kitchen, and somebody ate the last of them last night, and they didn't ask me at all, and I still don't know who it was. So then I went to shower, and I whacked my knee against the sink like a genius, and it's totally bruised, and I had a mouthful of Dentbots at the time, so I kind of swallowed some. And Dr. Chef says it's okay, but I have a tummy ache, which he said would happen, and then I finally got to take my stupid shower, but I noticed that the pressure was weird, so I started poking around the water reclamation systems, and I can tell there's a whole line of cabling that's fucked up, but I haven't found it yet. And now there's this big mess on the floor, and I still haven't gotten to any of the other stuff I needed to do today. And then I remembered that today's my cousin Kip's birthday, and he always has the best parties, and I'm totally missing it."
She sniffed again.
"And I know how stupid that all sounds, but I'm just not with it today, not at all."
Ashby put his hand on top of hers. "We all have days like that."
"I guess.
But you know, it's not even lunchtime yet. There's time for it to get better from here." She gave a glum nod.
"Yeah?"
"What was on your to-do list today?"
"Cleaning, mostly. The air filters all need a scrub. A sun lamp down and the fishbowl needs new wiring. And there's a floor panel coming loose in Ohan's room."
"Is any of that vital?"
"No, but it needs to get done."
"Just worry about getting the water lines fixed today. The rest can wait." He squeezed her hand. "And hey, there's nothing I can do about your cousin's birthday, but I know how tough that is. I'm sorry we've got such a long haul this time."
"Oh, stop,"
she said. "It's oodles of cash, and I love what we do. It's not like I'm your indentured servant or something. It was my choice to leave home." "Just because you leave home doesn't mean you stop caring about it. You wouldn't get homesick otherwise, and your family knows you care. I keep an eye on our linking traffic, you know. I see how many vid packs get sent to your family." Kizzy gave a mighty sniff and pointed to the hallway.
"You have to go now,"
she said,
"because I have to work and you're making me cry more. Not in a bad way, but you're making me all mushy, and if I hug you, I'll get gunk all over that nice shirt, which really brings out your eyes, by the way."
"Hey, everybody," Lovey said through the nearest vox. "There's a mail drone inbound. Packages on board for Ashby, Corbin, Jenks, Dr. Chef, and Kizzy. It'll be here in about 10 minutes.
"Eek!"
cried Kizzy.
"Mail! A mail drone!"
She tumbled out of the wall and ran down the hallway with her arms outstretched like shuttle wings.
"Interstellar goodies incoming!"
Ashby grinned. "Told you the day would get better," he called after her. She was too busy whooshing to reply. The cargo bay hatch adjusted itself, shrinking down to fit the mail drone's delivery port. As Ashby and the others waited, Sissix walked through the door. She'd put on a pair of trousers, and it looked like Dr. Chef had taken care of the molting problem.
"Hey,
Ashby said. Feeling better?
Much, she said.
Her skin was oddly bright, and a few dry ridges still lingered, but at least she didn't look like a peeling onion anymore.
I don't think there's anything for you.
So? She shrugged and smiled.
I'm nosy.
Just a moment, Lovey said. I'm scanning the contents for contaminants.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy,
said Kizzy.
It's my birthday!
Your birthday's not until middle year, said Jenks.
But it feels like my birthday. I love getting mail.
It's probably just those lockjaw clips you ordered.
Jenks, do you know how great lockjaw clips are?
There is nothing they can't hold down. Even my hair can't work its way out of them, and that's saying a lot. Ashby glanced over his shoulder at her. I'm going to pretend like you weren't talking about using the tech supplies I buy as hair accessories. Kizzy pressed her lips together.
Only in emergencies.
All clear, Lovey said. The hatch hissed open. A tray slid forward, holding a large sealed container. Ashby took the container and swiped his wrist wrap over the scan seal. The container gave an affirmative beep. A corresponding beep echoed from the mail drone on the other side of the hull. The tray retracted and the hatch closed. There was a muffled clank as the mail drone detached, off to find its next recipient. Ashby unsealed the lid and sorted through the parcels within. They were all plainly packaged, but even so, there was something charming about a bunch of boxes and tubes marked with his crew members' names. It did feel a little like a holiday. Here, Kizzy, he said, handing her a large package, before you explode. Kizzy's eyes grew wide.
It's not lockjaw clips! It's not lockjaw clips! I know who makes labels like this!
She slid back the lid and cheered.
It's from my dad's!
She dropped cross-legged onto the floor and pulled the lid open. Atop the package's contents, snacks and sundries, it looked like, was an info chip. Kizzy pulled her scrib from her belt, plugged in the chip, and began reading the text that appeared on the screen. Her face melted with sentiment.
It's a Just Cuz box, she said. They're the best. The best.
She tore into a fresh pack of fire shrimp as she continued reading. Ashby pulled out a small domed container blinking with biohazard warnings. Do I even want to know what this is? Dr. Chef puffed his cheeks.
Those will be my new seedlings. Completely harmless, I assure you. They have to put those warnings on any live cargo.
I know, it's just unnerving. Dr. Chef leaned close to Ashby, his eyes twinkling.
Don't tell, but if this is the order I think it is, I've now got a few starters of rosemary plants.
Ashby flipped over a box with a familiar brand logo, the same one he'd seen on a lot of algae tech. Corbin, he said, handing over the box. This looks like it's for you. Corbin opened the box and took out a circulation pump. He peered at the label and gave a short nod.
Seems our clerk can read order forms after all.
He headed for the exit.
Well? Good,
said Ashby noncommittally. He pulled a tiny box from the mail crate.
Jenks.
Jenks opened the box and removed an info chip.
What's that?
Sissix asked.
It's from Pepper, Jenks said.
He stared at the chip for a moment.
Oh, I bet it's those lateral circuit specs she mentioned last time I saw her.
Those sounded sweet, Kizzy said. She frowned. Why not just send them to your scrib? Jenks shrugged and put the chip in his pocket.
You know Pepper. She does things in her own special way.
Ashby leaned over the mail crate. There was one small, flat package remaining, addressed to himself. The label had no indication of who had sent it, but it required a wrist wrap scan. A flap snapped open as his wrist passed over it, and a frail rectangular object fell into Ashby's waiting palm.
What is that?
Sissix asked. Jenks let out a low whistle and stepped closer.
That's paper.
Kizzy's head snapped up.
Whoa,
she said, goggling at the object.
Is that a letter, like a physical one?
She jumped to her feet. Can I touch it?
Jenks smacked her hand away.
You've got fire shrimp crumbs all over your fingers.
Kizzy stuck a finger in her mouth, sucked it clean, and wiped it off on her work suit.
Jenks smacked her hand again. Now you've got crumbs and spit. A letter's not a scrib, Kizzy. You can't wash it off.
It's that fragile?
It's made from very thin sheets of dried tree pulp. What do you think?
Ashby ran his fingers along the leaf-like edges, doing his best to look nonchalant.
It was from Pei. It had to be.
Who else would go to that much trouble to send a message that couldn't be monitored? He turned the letter over in his hands.
How do I, hear? Jenks said, extending his palm. My hands are clean.
Ashby handed over the letter. Kiz, do you have your knife on you? Kizzy unsnapped a folded utility knife from her belt and handed it to Jenks. Her eyes widened with realization.
Wait, you're gonna cut it?
That's how you get the letter out of the envelope.
He flicked open the blade. Would you rather I tear it?
Kizzy looked horrified. Jenks deftly sliced the paper open.
My mom used to give me letters on special occasions when I was a kid, he said. Very special occasions. This stuff's expensive as hell.
He raised a wry eyebrow at Ashby.
Someone must like you a lot to send you this.
Like who? Kizzy asked. Jenks put his fist up to his mouth and gave an exaggerated harumphing cough.
Oh, said Kizzy in a stage whisper. I'll be going back to my snacks then.
She backed away with a knowing chuckle. Ashby glanced over to the others. Sissix was smirking. Dr. Chef's whiskers twitched in amusement.
All right, shut up, all of you.
He walked away, leaving the others to examine their new items while he read his letter in peace.
Hello, Ashby. Before you become too impressed with my ability to print by hand, you should know that I wrote all of this out on my scrib first. I tore through one of the sheets on my first try.
Honestly, how did your species communicate like this for millennia without becoming nervous wrecks?
Oh, wait. Right. Never mind. It feels like ages since Port Coriel. I miss your hands. I miss sharing a bed. I miss sharing stories. I'll never understand how you can be so patient with someone who can't talk to you for 10 days at a time. I'm not sure one of my own would have stayed with me through this. You humans and your blind stubbornness. Believe me, it's
Jenks, Ashby, Sissix, anyone?
It was Lovey. She sounded frantic.
We're in trouble.
Everyone in the cargo bay stopped to stare at the Vox. Out in the open, trouble was even less of a good thing than it was on the ground.
What's the problem? Ashby said.
There's a ship, another ship, coming in right at us. They've been blocking my scans with a dispersal field. Ashby, I'm so sorry.
That's not your fault, Lovey, Jenks said. Stay calm.
What kind of ship? Ashby said.
I don't know,
Lovey said.
Smaller than us, pinhole drive. I think it's a very small homesteader, but I don't know why a homestead ship would...
Corbin came running back into the cargo bay.
Ship, he gasped. Out the window, it's...
The whole ship rocked. The sounds of falling objects clanged down the hallway. Everyone started shouting.
Ashby's stomach dropped.
Something had hit them.
Lovey, what?
Some kind of weapon blast. Our navigation's knocked out.
Sissix hissed profanities. Kizzy nodded at Jenks and jumped to her feet.
Let's go, she said.
No, Lovey said.
I can get us moving in 5 minutes, but the primary navigation hub's completely fused. I can't tell which way we're going.
Fused? Kizzy cried. What the fuck did they hit us with? Lovey, are you sure?
Sissix looked at Ashby. I can navigate the old-fashioned way, but not in 5 minutes. Not if we want to be safe about it.
Pirates, said Jenks. Remember, Kiz, on the news, fucking pirates following mail drones in using scatter bursts to fry nav systems.
Oh, no, moaned Corbin.
Ashby stared at Jenks.
Lovey, how long until they reach us?
Half a minute. There's nothing I can do. I'm sorry.
This isn't happening, Kizzy said.
They can't.
Shit, said Jenks. Quick, everybody hide your stuff.
He pulled open an empty crate and threw Kizzy's package in. Dr. Chef followed suit. There was a crash, a horrible, scraping, wrenching crash, right into the cargo bay doors. Corbin jumped behind a crate and covered his head.
They're overriding the door controls, Lovey said. Ashby,
It's okay, Lovey, Ashby said. We'll take care of it. He had no idea what that would entail.
Oh, fuck,
Kizzy said, tugging at her hair.
Oh, fuck, fuck, fuck.
Stay calm, Dr. Chef said. He put his arm around Kizzy's shoulders.
Everyone stay calm.
Ashby took a few steps toward the bay doors, dumbfounded. This wasn't real. It couldn't be. A whirring sound on the other side argued otherwise. The doors clanked open. Sissek stood beside him, shoulders back, feathers on end.
I don't know what to do, she said.
Me neither, Ashby said.
Think, damn it.
His brain cycled through a jumble of options. Find a weapon, run away, hide, hit them with something. But there was no time. Four sapients in hulking mech suits came through the bay doors, all carrying battered pulse rifles. Their suits were large, bigger than a human, but the creatures housed within were small, spindly, bird-like. Acorax. Ashby had seen Acorax before, on Port Coriel. Everyone knew how the Harmagians had treated them, back in the colonial days. Their planet was left barren, their water sources polluted, their forests stripped. Their home world had nothing for them, but neither did anywhere else. They were a rare sight out in the galaxy, but they could be found here and there, working in scrapyards or begging on corners. Or, if they had run out of options, boarding ships and taking what they pleased. Ashby put up his palms. The Acorax voices came from tiny voxes inlaid below their helmets, shrieking and shrill. They weren't speaking clip.
Don't shoot, Ashby said. Please, I can't understand you. Clip, do you speak clip?
There was no discernible response, only shrieks and clicks and angry waves of their weapons. The words meant nothing to him, but the guns did. Ashby felt a bead of sweat trickle down his brow. He brushed his hand across his face.
Okay, listen. We'll cooperate, just...
The world exploded in pain as an Acorax swung the butt of its rifle up to meet Ashby's jaw. The Acorax, the cargo bay, Sissek shouting, Kizzy screaming, Jenks cursing, all of it disappeared behind a curtain of red light. His knees buckled. The floor rushed up to meet his face. Then, nothing.